and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. He's a New York Times best-selling author, James Rollins, and his new book is called The Devil Colony. It's a Sigma Force novel, and it's out in all your bookstores tomorrow right now. Now, this is Sigma Force number 7, James?
That is correct, number 7.
I love these characters. I just absolutely love these characters. Are you at all getting tired of writing about them, or do you find that each adventure is more fun than the last?
Well, I mean, I've been writing these characters now for almost a decade, and you know, to me, they're like my brothers and sisters. I mean, I swear sometimes I turn a corner and expect to see them standing there having breakfast or something. I do alternate by doing either a standalone or doing one of my kids' books. So that acts as enough of a palate cleanser to not feel like I'm just writing the same group of characters over and over and over again.
Right.
So by alternating between a different project and the Sigma book allows me to keep to the point where I'm ready to write them. I'm actually missing them. I'm glad to go back to writing them.
Right. I read the first Jake Ransom book. That was really cool. The kids one. Now I think there's two out now, right?
And the second one came out about 8 weeks ago, I think.
So how do you balance doing the adult and doing the kids? Do you get confused sometimes?
Not so much confused. I mean, because they're very, very different, styles and characters and plot. I mean, the middle school series has a lot of magic and time travel, and my 13-year-old boy archaeologist running around amok.
How does that start? I mean, do you go to the publisher with that idea, or did they come to you and say, I want you to write a children's series? How does that work?
I knew I wanted to do something different, and I come up with this idea of basically doing like Harry Potter goes prehistoric, taking this kid and thrusting him into a prehistoric landscape with lost civilizations and having him struggle to find out what happened to his missing archaeologist parents. And so I pitched it to Harper, and they were like, thumbs up, yeah.
Now, this book, The Devil Calling, which I read all of yesterday, it's one of those books you just can sit and enjoy for hours. And it's 460 pages. I read very slowly. One doesn't know that. Most people think I read fast, but I have to understand everything that's going on in the book, so I find myself slowing down. And I could read faster, but then I'd lose what I was reading. But there are more than a few characters, but they're all interesting characters. Now, Lee Child says nobody, and I mean nobody, does this stuff better than Rollins. What a compliment that is.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to get that tattooed across my chest, I think.
But to say that, I mean, there's a lot of people writing these kinds of books, but yours are definitely stand out because they're so full of interesting information, things we didn't know about. I mean, things about Thomas Jefferson, and I mean, you go all over the place with this one, and Yellowstone Park, which is that right? It's really 2 million miles worth of. That's how big the park is.
2 million. I can't remember now. Since a while since actually.
Oh, it's not 2 million miles. 2 million square miles.
Yeah, square miles.
Miles would be forever.
Yeah, the largest supervolcano.
It's hard to imagine the scope of that, of the size of that place. I mean, you hear about it, but you never think about how big it must be. And
last time that volcano erupted, it tore a hole in the Earth's crust about the size of Rhode Island. Yeah, it's big.
Now, you've actually been to Yellowstone.
I have many times, actually. Growing up, I've been there a couple times, and then just specifically for researching this novel, I went up there.
Now, did you go there for the book? Did you stand there and make notes when you were there, or
I did. I mean, I don't live that far from Yellowstone, so it was an easy jaunt compared to usually my Sigma adventures are they're global adventures, all corners of the world. But being that it's almost my own backyard, it was easy to make a trip up there. Because, some authors do travel for research, and it's very rare, actually, that I actually will plot out a novel, and then I will then hop on a plane and run around and research. Usually I just travel for the fun of it, and I gather a bunch of notes, and take a bunch of photographs, and I journal about it. I ask locals, odd questions like, what's the secret about this place, or what's a mystery that no one knows about this place? Again, just looking for seeds of ideas for new places, and I just gather all that together, and I put it in a big folder, and it goes on my bookshelf, and whenever my characters have to stumble across that area, I pretty much have most of my background research already done.
And it's so interesting the way you write your books, you come up with all these different hypotheses, and then the characters are trying to figure out what's really going on. I think to myself, you've got to have some kind of a mind to think up all these things. I mean, it's not like And everything has to make sense. You can't just bring something out of the blue and have it make any sense. It's got to make some kind of sense. It's got to be based on some kind of historical facts.
Yeah, I mean, I try to, without a doubt, my stories have tended to branch off into strange territory, but I like to start in a very grounded reality. You know, at the end of each of my novels, I sort of lay out what's true and what's not in a little sort of addendum section, mostly because in my earlier novels, I wasn't doing that, and I had to field a lot of email questions. You know, is this part true? Is that part true? And oftentimes, what sounds the most outlandish in the story oftentimes is the piece that's actually true. And, you know, I've always got my feelers up for, you know, that bit of history that ends in a question mark or that bit of science that makes me go, what if? And I gather them in this is basically just a cardboard lawyer's box. They don't organize, they just stuff everything in there. And I try to limit it to just that one box, because if I don't, then one box will become two boxes and becomes four boxes. And, you know, before you know it, it'll be New York Times bestselling author James Rollins on Hoarders. So to keep it limited to one box, I have to every now and again go cull through it, and I'll dump my box over, and weird things will end up next to each other on the floor. That little bit of history, that little bit of science, and I look down and see, well, I can vaguely see how that connects together. And I'll follow, and I'll realize, no, it doesn't really. But other times, I'll find out this layer and layer builds up as I investigate, and that's pretty much what happened with this story.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And when I first started reading it, I thought, I don't know, it didn't grab me, and then all of a sudden it did, and I couldn't stop reading it. This is one of those books where just, the more you read it, the more you can't stop reading it, and that's how I felt with this one. It's interesting the way books are nowadays. I pick up a book, and sometimes if I don't like it in the first 20 or so pages, I'm half tempted to put it down, but thank goodness I didn't put yours down, because it's just so wonderful. It's one of the, and I hate to see it end, because I know there isn't another one for a problem. This one took you for a while to write, longer than the others. Why? What was it? What was
a
it?
A couple of reasons. I took a break into a standalone novel, Altar of Eden, that came out about a year and a half ago.
Oh, that was a standalone. I didn't realize that. Oh, okay.
And the last Sigma novel was 2 years ago, so I had done sort of two big novels that year. So that set me back a little bit. But also, this novel was. Took a bit more research than my typical story. Usually I limit myself to 90 days of research, and that 91st day I want to start actually writing. Otherwise, I'll just keep researching. Nothing actually will be put onto paper.
Right.
This novel, I had to break that rule. It took probably twice that long just to do the front-end loading of the research, because this is the first time I've really pulled Sigma into the U.S. to have pretty much an entirely U.S.-based story. And so I had to make sure every I was dotted and T was crossed, and I was raising some issues that were a bit controversial. So again, I wanted to make sure, you know, all my ducks were in line, and that everything was gonna, you know, that was gonna work was gonna work. So this took a bit of extra time to craft this novel.
Yeah, but it's well worth the effort and the time. I mean, and that's the beauty of reading this book. You realize how much work went into writing this. I mean, we think of writing a book, you think, oh, you just sit down and write it, you write a story and that's it. But it isn't, there's so much involved with a novel like this, with the research, and making sure everything's right, and making sure you sound coherent, and you're talking about things that are really of interest to people. And, you know, Mormons, we find out a little bit about the Mormons. Now, you say yourself you're very curious about the Mormons.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised Roman Catholic, but, you know, all my stories have a tendency to deal with either different aspects of religion or mythology or history of different places, and I'm always looking for, you know, those seeds of truth behind stories that might sound a little outlandish. And this whole book actually started out because I was having a dinner party, and a couple of friends of mine who are Mormon they started out civilly having a discussion about one aspect of the Book of Mormon, but it became more and more heated. And one was very orthodox in his Mormon beliefs, one was a little more liberal in his Mormon beliefs. And they were arguing about one tenet of the Book of Mormon that it's a bit controversial, they get a lot of flack from it, and what it that dealt with was, according to the Book of Mormon, that the Native American tribes of North America are said to be descendants out of a lost tribe out of Israel. And on face value, that seems a wild claim. Genetics don't seem to support such a claim. But as heated as these two gentlemen were about that subject, I thought, well, maybe there's a seed of truth behind here. Can I research and find out more about that? So that sent me into looking into Mormonism, into some of the tenets, looking into Native American history, looking into the early history of this continent, the migrations to this continent, and pieces began to fall together in sort of an astounding manner. Things that, you know, just almost it was it was odd the way one piece would align the next person, next piece that would align with the next piece. So it was almost like, you know, creating a different tapestry of the early history of this continent and the founding of this country.
Right. And it this book starts out in Utah. Now, why did you pick Utah? What was it about Utah?
Well, I knew I was dealing with the history with Mormonism, and I needed to hide something of value that possibly has ties to this Israelite/Native American tie. And so I figured a good spot to place that would be somewhere in Utah. And I've been to that area before. I've been into that national forest. It's a beautiful area, so I thought that'd be a good place to start.
You do get around quite a bit. And do you travel a lot during the course of the year?
I do. I travel a lot. Matter of fact, I just finished the book tour, just winding up the book tour actually for this novel, and I've been on the road for 3 weeks, crossing from one side of the country to the other. But I love to travel. I'm always on the road, checking to different places, and you know, I've been to 6 out of the 7 continents. Haven't been to Antarctica yet, but I'll get there one of these days.
I love the confidence. That's great. Actually, the book starts out in Kentucky, the Kentucky Territory, in the autumn of 1779. What was that? I'm sorry?
Back in the colonial era in Kentucky.
Now, this guy, Archard Fortescue, how come I haven't heard of him before. I mean, he was a real person.
No, he's a fictional person.
Oh, he is fictional?
Yes, he is.
I thought he was real. You had me convinced he's real.
Well, that's my goal.
I really thought I was ready to look him up online. It's like, Fortescue, it's interesting how...
Yeah, I mean, basically, all the stuff he's spouting and believing in and is based on real science and real history. It's just the character itself is a made-up figure.
Right, well, of course, he's not in the book. He's actually dead in the book. Like I said, you had me convincing. I mean, that's how convincing you were with these historical things. Now, how much research did you do with Lewis and Clark? Meriwether Lewis. We can't really give too much about the book away, but
I'll give a little bit of away. I mean, Meriwether Lewis was Thomas Jefferson's secretary. Eventually, got handpicked to join Clark on the expedition to the West to discover the Pacific Ocean and to explore the Louisiana Purchase. But a little true bit of fact was that in 1803, Jefferson had submitted a letter to Congress revealing that there was actually another purpose to the Lewis and Clark expedition beyond pure exploration. It was kept secret. It was only between Jefferson and the Congress about what that purpose was. Of course, I revealed that in the book.
Right.
And what also fascinated me, what started me on this whole thing, was the fact that for the last two centuries, Meriwether Lewis' death was ruled a suicide. And only recently is that now in dispute, and the consensus now across for most historians is that it was not suicide, it was murder. And I don't know, again, when I was doing my research, you know, here we have Meriwether Lewis, a known skilled marksman when he was on his journey out west. There's many anecdotes of him, you know, shooting a bear at some great distance, and he was known to be an expert marksman, yet this expert marksman, when he commits suicide, he shoots himself in the belly, he shoots himself in the head, yet still lives another 8 hours. You know, that does not sound, to me, like a suicide. So again, as a thriller writer, I'm wondering, if I don't think that's suicide, why did anybody else think that was suicide? Was somebody covering something up? Was there another story behind this? Why was this kept secret? And you know, again, that builds into the story.
Right. And also, Alzheimer's comes into play with one of the characters' parents.
It's been an ongoing issue with my main character, Commander Grayson Pierce. Grayson's
right.
Father was diagnosed in the very first book having early stages of Alzheimer, and over the course of the books, I just don't like stories and the characters stay static. That is sort of a bit of a burden that has been plaguing Gray throughout the series, and it somewhat comes to a head in this novel, where he has to balance family life with his professional life, which, you know, of course, all of us have to do, and so I think it gives me a chance to humanize this basic, you know, guy who's been an action hero in the previous novel.
So you haven't been dealing with it in real life. I thought maybe you had somebody in...
I do. I mean, it is semi-autobiographical in some regards. In this case, it's my mother that's suffering from that.
Sorry to hear that.
I definitely relate to what Gray is going through.
Right. Now, does she live near you?
She does, yeah.
Oh, that's good. Oh, that's terrible. I mean, my father had it too. I guess it's so prevalent now. I mean, it seems
It's tough. I mean, it's tough for the person suffering from it. It's tough on the family. So I was trying to capture that.
Right, and it's you know you can feel his frustration dealing with his father and his mother's frustration too. So it's you know it's interesting how you weave all these things together right in the middle of running around finding out about this stuff. He's you know getting phone calls from his mother and things like that, and this makes it even more interesting.
I think it definitely is one way that you know. You don't want your main character to be Superman. I mean, Superman needs his kryptonite. It's important that we find ways to humanize, make our characters fallible, and feel real. So when we put them in jeopardy, that you know, you're going to be concerned for them.
How do your books sell overseas? I can imagine there's a lot of interest overseas for these books.
Oh, they are. They sell very well overseas. Matter of fact, I just learned that not that it's necessarily overseas, but our great neighbor to the north, Canada, Devil Colony, is currently number one.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great. And you're on the New York Times right now. What number are you on the New York Times?
Started out number three, then went down to number six.
You were number three?
I was number three, yeah.
That's impressive. I mean, that's really impressive.
I was thrilled.
I knew it was on the other side. I didn't realize it was all the way up to number three. That's, wow.
Debuted at number three.
That's terrific. So people, and that's the great thing. I mean, even though it took you a little bit longer to write this, people were coming into the store and they're like, where's the next James Rollins? Where is it? They always expect it's going to be out the same time every year when it's not. Everybody's, you know, like, what happened to him?
Exactly.
They don't understand the extra time it took. I mean, I knew it was coming out. It's just that, you know, it was a little bit later than usual. And well, we know you're doing a good job with it. So, I mean, it isn't a concern that way. We know we're going to get a good book when it does finally come out.
I'd rather do a good book than a rushed book.
Does each one of your books seem to do better than the one before?
Lucky enough, yes. Yeah, I do seem to be, each year, the books seem to be selling a little stronger.
What do you try to do with each book? I mean, how do you approach each book?
Well, you know, for the longest time, I actually resisted doing a series. That's why all my earlier books were standalone adventures. I didn't have a series.
So at one point, you really just wanted to do standalones?
Initially, I did standalones in the beginning. I introduced Sigma in my standalone called Sandstorm, and
right.
I liked that team. I thought, well, I could actually spin this team into its own series. Because getting a lot of pressure from the house to do a series, I was just resistant a little bit. And the reason why is, it's what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome from Murder, She Wrote.
Right.
Jessica Fletcher was always stumbling across dead bodies every week. And after a while, you know, it begins to strain believability. Your suspension of disbelief begins to fade because I know I've never stumbled over a dead body, let alone as many as she did. So eventually begin to suspect, you know, is she really a serial killer? Is she the one really knocking off all these people and shaming other people? So I was resistant to do a series because I just had that issue. But when I created the team, I thought, well, with a team, the threat can come from so many different directions that I can step away from a little bit of that issue. Also, again, with Jessica Fletcher, as much as you might want her to die in that episode, you know she's not going to.
Right.
She's going to have to be in there next week. So the sense of jeopardy is also compromised when you have a serious character because you know those serious characters have to be in the next book, so they're probably not going to get killed.
There's exceptions. I mean, I can think of some lately, especially I'm thinking of Karen Slaughter killing off her main character. And, you know, it does happen, and when it does, people are shocked. And the only problem is if it's a memorable character, people are going to miss that character.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm not even sure when I read your books who's going to live and die till the end. I mean, sometimes I think they're dead.
With a team, you know, I can always knock off a major character and then the next book, you know, have a new recruit that takes their place.
Right.
So I have the ability to maintain jeopardy that way.
So is there any plan at some point to kill off some of these main characters? Not that I want you to tell me who, but, I mean, do you think about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in this next book, the sequel to this book that, you know, picks up pretty much where this book leaves off, it concludes the major story arc with the Guild. So the
main really? The Guild's coming back? Ooh.
Yep, and this will resolve that whole storyline, and I can't say that everybody's going to survive that. That's all I'll say.
Oh, my. Well, now I can't wait to read it. There's just something so enjoyable about your books. I mean, and people tell me that that they just love to read. They love the series. Like you said, the series is what really gets people. I just had a guy in the store today, and he just was telling me all these different series he liked, that he just loves. And, you know, and people fall in love with these characters, and I can't wait to see what's going to happen to Painter and Grayson. I mean, how they're going to react to each other. And I mean, I assume Kia. Is it Kia, the niece?
Uh-huh.
Hey, will she be back?
No, not in this next book.
But at some point?
Probably so. I mean, I do like the fact that I can bring back characters like Kowalski, the Finn Sigma, was first introduced in my standalone Ice Hunt.
Wasn't there a Kowalski in Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea?
Yeah, there could be. I don't know. Kowalski is fairly common. So, you know,
I thought maybe as a child you would watch that show. Maybe
I
that's
had,
it.
But maybe somewhere deep in my memory that was pulled up there. But
he's a great character on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. He's one of these characters that you remember after the show's over. He just was kind of a wisecracking, funny guy. The guy who
you always say that's a little bit of comic relief.
Right, comic relief, exactly. And then that's what, there's some of that in your book, too. And I guess there has to be some kind of comic relief. It can't all be serious.
You know, somebody that says a little lighter. I mean, Monk takes a little lighter view on a lot of things. Kowalski is always good for a laugh every now and again. So it's good to have, you know, something that lightens the, you know, the world's in danger type of major threat going on.
Now, I think I can ask about this. I don't think this will give anything away. But his prosthetic arm... Monks. That's not, such a thing does exist.
It does, yeah. I mean, actually, if anything, my prosthetic is not as state-of-the-art as what's now being engineered at DARPA and DARPA labs right now to help with some of the wounded warriors coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
But his actually lights up at one point?
Well, his can actually, you know, his it's got an actuator built into the wrist cuff, so he can actually control the hand independently, so he can scurry off on his own, and he can manipulate it. And it's got a little sort of weapons bay that he put different types of in this case explosives or different types of weapons into the hand.
Right. I love the fact he's got kids, too. So it's like out in the middle of all this running around and endangering his life, he's got kids that are back home. And you think to yourself, well, why is this guy doing that? He's got a family.
And I like that, man. I like the fact that, you know, his wife is a little bit leery of him going on these trips, yet recognizes that it's part of him that really needs to do these things. And how do you balance putting yourself at risk when you do have a family at home?
So you like to put all these, I guess what we'd say, conundrums about how one thing balances another, why people are doing things, what's the motivation, who's the baddie, who's the goodie, and, you know, there's a real baddie in this one, by the way, who I really enjoy.
All the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're facing, I mean, they've got family at home, they've got kids at home, and yet they're putting themselves at risk being out there, and so, I mean, I just like, I let, that's reality, you know, even our, the heroes of today, they're usually putting themselves at risk, yet have to recognize that there is family at home that is going to suffer if something happens to them.
We haven't yet described, maybe you should describe to people who haven't read Devil Colony, just the basic plot, because we've been dancing all around it, but you haven't really described.
Well, the novel starts out with the discovery of a cache of ancient mummies in a cavern system in the Rocky Mountains, but something odd about the mummies. They appear to be wearing Indian garb, yet genetics seem to point that they seem to be Caucasian. And there's a rumor about that, or legend surrounding that cavern, Indian legend stating that if anybody enters that cave and leaves, it would trigger the end of the world. And indeed, that's what begins to happen.
That's a pretty succinct... Do you consider yourself like a gadget freak? I mean, you seem to... There's a lot of gadgets in your books, a lot of guns and weapons and knives and things. I mean, do you have a lot of this stuff at your house?
I do. I have a lot of different stuff at the house. I also have some friends that are in the military, and some of them will feed me, you know, little intel about, you know, new weapons or new weapon systems that are out there. And there's some fun stuff to play with.
Almost like, who's the one in James Bond that always comes up with these weapons? Was that Q or...
Q, I think, is the one that has the cool weapons.
Which I think are the most... I don't know if they had it the last movie or not. I can't remember if they're doing it with Daniel Craig. So that's some of the most fun part of that shit.
And well, I always thought it was too.
I mean, it's just what's the newest gadget? That's why I'd love to go to Sharper Image. I don't know if you have Sharper Image stores out there.
They do, and I had gone when I was in D.C. the last time. They have a spy museum.
Oh, really?
That covers all the different what Q was inventing was not actually that different from what was used in reality. There's some cool stuff, some great ideas actually got out of that spy museum that are going to appear in my novel.
Right. Now, it's interesting. Looking at the outside of your book, there's that little upside-down V with the moon and the stars, which comes into play. I don't want to say too much about it because it comes into play in the story as the story unfolds. But you always seem to have these symbols in your books. That seems to be a big interest with you.
It is. I mean, basically, I've been dabbling with on the edge of, the secret within secret societies. You know, what is there... is there that big conspiracy, or is that all just hokum? And so it's fun dealing with symbols. I always liked books that had things like that in them growing up.
So you're writing about things that you were really interested in growing up, things that you thought about a lot growing up.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I still think that what I'm writing today is basically just a modern spin on those old pulp novels from the 30s and 40s. I mean, I turn around right now in my office here, and I've got 181 Doc Savage novels.
Which novels?
Doc Savage.
I don't even know who... Oh, Doc Savage. Oh, yeah, of course.
And Shadow and the Avenger and the Spider. A lot of these 30s and 40s pulp characters. Bantam did some reprints of those old pulps. And back when I was in high school, I became sort of addicted to those things.
How fun is it to go to other people's houses and see what they collect and see what...
I always do that.
I mean, it is just so much fun. I love to look at what other people... You think to yourself, well, I think I collect weird stuff. Let's see what other people collect. I mean, I'm just surrounded by books here because that's my main love is books, really. But it's so interesting to see what... I mean, you hear these people on TV, oh, I have 5,000 records and 10,000... I mean, what do you do with all these things? But it really brings people pleasure, though. It's something that makes life more interesting.
Yeah. I'd rather look at people's collections than in their medicine cabinets.
Now, is there ever any thought to putting these books into, like, graphic novel form?
I mean, I'm an avid comic book reader myself.
I'd love to see a graphic novel of one of these.
Oh, I'd love to see that, too. I mean, I've been to Comic-Con every year for the last 12 years.
Have you really? How cool? Do you get a big crowd when you go?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they draw 80,000 people there, so even just a minor panel draw big audiences. You're generally looking at, talking to rooms of anywhere from 600 to 1,000 people in one room.
Now, that's coming up next weekend, isn't it?
Yep, next weekend.
Now, you're going to be there for that, too?
I can't do it this year. I got a conflict this year, which is just crushing me. It's the first year, and like I said, 12
years. Oh, no. It's a golden opportunity, I guess. That's a shame. But you do the International Thriller Writers every year.
I do, yeah.
What is the biggest thrill for you for that? I mean, I know a lot of people talk about how great it is. What do you get out of it, other than a lot of exposure?
I mean, exposure isn't great there, because usually you're just talking mostly to your own colleagues. It's mostly just the camaraderie. It's my one chance. It's almost like, it's a summer camp for thriller writers. You get to see your old friends that you haven't seen in a while, and spend until 2 o'clock in the bar talking shop, and it's just a lot of fun.
And it's to meet other people that are doing exactly what you're doing, only writing different kinds of books. It's just got to be. I mean, these are people with just amazing minds, and. Are you getting ideas while you go to these things, too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, whenever you get that type of energy, I have a tendency to leave those, not just ITW, but any conference I go to, it just really gets those juices flowing, the energy, so I just get a slew of ideas.
Now, Sigma Force, well, it can go on and on and on and on, or is there an end somewhere?
Well, the major sort of arc with the Guild ends in this next book.
Right.
I will be starting another arc with I don't want to tell too much, but there's something else starts in the next novel also.
Oh, cool. Now, do you have a title for the next book yet?
I don't, no. We're still working on that. I pitched about like 50 titles to my editor. And
this seems like it's one of the longer books that you've had put out. Now, some people are calling it your best book. Now,
it's one of my longer ones. It's not the longest one, but it's Sandstorm, so the prequel to the series, is longer than this. But of the actual true Sigma novels with Gray, featuring Gray. This is the longest of that bunch.
Does it ever seem like you run out of ideas, or do you constantly?
Oh, God, no. I mean, at this point, like I said, I've got that idea box, and I wish I could clone myself because I have like 4 or 5 ideas that I just love to write right now, but I just don't have the physical time to do that.
So what now, obviously the next week you said it continues with this, so you already have that plan up. But how do you decide what to do next? Is it just simply what you're interested in the most? What is in your mind the most, and then you write about it?
Well, oftentimes I will, you know, one book will seed a hint of what's going to happen in the next book. So usually I've already got the next book somewhat already pinned down to write. It's a book after that that's somewhat amorphous. I don't know what we're going to deal with exactly in that book, and that's where it, you know.
Do you ever get writer's block?
The only time I've actually had that type of issue is when I've painted my characters into a corner. I don't necessarily know how to get them out of that corner, but if I've jammed them up that well that I don't know how to get them out of that corner, it's a pretty good corner. So then I'll have to stop and think of some way to get them out of that. Sometimes I'll have to actually stop.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that. There are parts of this book where you think, well, how's he gonna get these characters out alive? There's just no way. And that's the beauty of your novels. You always come up with these creative ways to get them out. But it has to be plausible. You just can't say, oh, suddenly the roof opened and they flew out.
You know, you can't have the hand of God solving your...
But that's what the fun of your books is. When we read them, we just see where they are. You can just imagine this place, you can imagine them going to the Fort Knox, which, oh my gosh, I want to go to Fort Knox just reading about it from your book. And I would assume that does get people interested in going to these places. Now, you've been to Fort Knox, I take it.
I've not been inside Fort Knox, like I said, only a handful of people have been, but there was a documentary special about Fort Knox that filmed inside the vault, so I was able to actually...
So all the scenes are based on what you saw in that?
Exactly. So it's real. So what I describe is the way that everything actually is in Fort Knox.
I mean, who knew it was so? I mean, it doesn't really surprise me, I guess, but you never really think about it until you actually go and you see how really closed off it is and how difficult it is to get in.
Right, I've been by Fort Knox. I drove past it just to sort of visually see how it's relation to the base that's around it.
So how big is it?
The Fort Knox itself?
Yeah.
It's a fairly large facility, but not as much as you think, as much as the reputation is. I don't know how many square feet it is. I probably have somewhere in my notes, but I just can't pull it off out of hand.
Mm-hmm. But it's big.
It's big, but it's like a small castle. You know, it's got these little guard towers at each corner that look like little turrets on a castle.
What would it take for somebody to get in there? I mean, what do you have to go through to get in there?
To get permission, you have to have a presidential order to actually go into Fort Knox.
There's no visiting allowed.
Nope. Only 2 presidents since the place was established have actually walked into Fort Knox.
Who were they? I put you on the spot.
No, I mean, I think Franklin was in there, and somebody after him, Truman, I think, was in it too.
But can the president just say, I want to go to Fort Knox, and he's there? I mean,
yes. But even he's got to, there's some hoops even he has to, you know, a certain amount of permission he can't just, like, pop in there and knock on the door and say, I want to go in. There's a whole set of protocol he has to follow.
So you're really doing a lot for tourism. I mean, we read your books and we want to go to these places. I mean, they're just fascinating places. And Yellowstone, Yellowstone is just amazing. I mean, just reading about it, it just makes me want to be there.
Well, it's a beautiful place. I would avoid summertime. Fall and spring are great times to go to Yellowstone.
Now, are the geysers continually going off?
Oh, yeah.
That's every 90 minutes of the whole day?
For Old Faithful, yeah.
Wow. That's really cool. There's so many cool things you write about that I feel like I'm going to become interested in all these things eventually. But I can't imagine. I can only imagine you as a little kid and what was going through your mind. And I mean, did you know you'd be a best-selling author?
Oh no! I mean, my goal when I was growing up was to be a veterinarian.
Which you are.
Which I am. I mean, I remember still from third grade. Get that assignment that all third grade teachers give you is what do you want to be when you grow up? And I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. I just remember remember sitting at my desk going, I want to be a veterinarian, I just don't know how to spell it. And I remember actually going out and getting a dictionary to look it up, because I was that determined from third grade to be a veterinarian. But, you know, I loved telling stories and spinning tales, and I read a lot in junior high and high school, and that was like throwing gasoline on that.
Well, how do you balance it? How are you a vet and a writer at the same time? That's got to be a lot of work.
Well, now I write full time, and I just use my veterinary degree as a hobby.
Okay.
Back when I was still owning my clinic and running it and writing, you know, my clients began to get a little suspicious that I was writing, because, you know, I had posters in my lobby, you know, get your cat spayed, get a free book.
Oh, really?
They began to ask me a question. Well, Jim, what's your game plan here? You got a successful veterinary hospital, and now you're writing. You know, what's your long-term goal? And I always told them, well, you know, for 15 years, my veterinary degree was my paycheck, and my writing was my hobby, and I thought it would be really cool to flip that around and eventually have writing be my paycheck and my veterinary degree be my hobby. And it's sort of nice to have, you know, achieve that. So I work with a group that traps feral or wild cats. They bring them to the shelter, and one Sunday a month, I spend about 8 hours spaying and neutering them. And then they're re-released where they were trapped, basically an attempt to turn off those kitten factories out there.
Right. So you got a lot going on in your life. That's great. I mean, but do you think writing's really what brings you the most joy?
I still can't believe I get paid for it, to be honest with you, because it just seems like I'm playing, you know, spinning these stories and telling these weird stories, and people keep buying them, which is great.
And coming up with all these ideas and how they all interact. I mean, when you think about writing Devil Colony, I mean, you think about it has to do with the Mormons and Fort Knox and Yellowstone all together. How does that come about? How do you think of all these things being interacting together? I mean, it's got to take some kind of brilliant mind to come up with all this stuff.
Sometimes it's actually just pure luck of just sifting through my things and seeing things fall together. Or, like I said, it started with an argument and sent me looking into Native Americans, which sent me into the founding of this country.
So you're actually starting arguments with people just so you... I mean, you must be a great person at a party. I can imagine that the subject you talk about.
Yeah, I worried my clients a lot, my veterinary clients, when they started to read my books. It's like, I'm not quite sure I want you to be my veterinarian anymore.
Oh, really? Is that what they say to you?
No, they were just joking, because, you know, there's some pretty murderous and violent things that occur in my books, so I think they...
There are. Does that get your frustration?
The veterinarian does not quite, you know, didn't quite mesh with the sadistic killer I created in this other book or something.
Yeah, and it's interesting that when the bad guys are around, some of them don't last very long. Sometimes they go out really quick, and it's really interesting. It's really cool the way you do that. I mean, it is. It's sort of like a total annihilation of the enemy sometimes. You know, you never quite know whether they're dead sometimes, right away. Sometimes you like to tease us with that.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of two characters in particular, which we can't talk about, which I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, but of which I thought weren't going to make it all the way to the end. But that's part of the fun of reading your books. We don't really know who's going to make it to the end.
Exactly.
And even the main character, like we were saying. So in the future, you do want to do more Sigma Force novels, and you do want to do some standalones.
Correct.
I like to
mix them up. I mean, I think it's good just to keep myself fresh, not to do the same book over and over again, to do the same characters over and over again. I just like to do something different.
Right.
The palate cleanser.
Do you have a great idea for a standalone, even as we speak?
I do. I mean, I've actually pitched an idea for actually a sequel to Altar of Eden, which featured a veterinarian in the lead role.
Probably
the first veterinary thriller.
And how did the publisher like that idea?
Yeah, I got the thumbs up on that, so...
Oh, that's great.
When I finish this novel, I'll probably start working on that.
Now, what was the reaction of your fans to The Altar of Eden, that it wasn't a Sigma Force? Were they disappointed?
Not at all. I mean, a lot of them have been clamoring to have one of my standalones. There's, like, a lot of fans that really like the standalones more than the Sigma. Some people like the Sigma more than the standalones. And again, it was, you know, I had Sigma out in the summertime, and then the Altar of Eden came out in the winter, so it wasn't like, you know, if you wanted to read the standalone, you could. If not, you know, the Sigma members didn't have all that much more to wait.
Do you ever work on two books? Can you ever work on two books at a time? I mean, can you work on a Sigma Force and a Jake?
I tried doing that back a few books ago, and that's just too hard for me to do that.
I can't imagine doing
that. I have to immerse myself in a book and to have to pull myself out and insert myself into the other story. It's just too challenging.
So how do you... Now, I realize that Jay Grant's of her kids, but how do you transfer your name? I mean, you have a very sellable name, obviously, a very, very sellable name, but how do you transfer those sales up over to kids? I mean, what kind of a marketing thing do they do for you for that?
Well, it's a different house. I mean, HarperCollins is publishing both, but it's HarperCollins Children, so they have their own marketing department. It's and marketing with kids is a totally different kind of worms than it is for the adult novels. The book tour for the kids was, I think that's one of my hardest book tours ever, because, you know, basically when you're doing a book tour for kids, you're going to a lot of schools.
Right.
But I'd hit a city, and I'd do two schools during the day, and then I'd do my book event at night. So you're doing, like, three different events in you know, each city that you go to. So
oh, my God, and that's just one day.
And those kids, they're a tough audience.
They don't hold back at all. I mean,
no, they don't.
You think the adults are bad. The kids. But how do you get big crowds for your adult events? I would assume you do.
Yeah, we generally, this past tour, we've been getting on average probably like 100 to 150 people per signing. Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less.
Right. You strike me as somebody who is, well, I mean, you come across, just talking to you, as kind of a shyer kind of guy, but I don't think you really are.
No, I'm a little bit shy.
I mean, don't writers have a lot of shyness in them, do you think?
I think there's a whole gamut. I think probably on average, there's more introverts than there are extroverts, but I've met many authors that, you know, do have very outgoing personalities.
Right. I think Lee Child has a very outgoing personality, but you sense, even as you meet him, that there is some kind of shyness about him. There is kind of a... I mean, when you become that famous, I mean, there's got to be times where you just want to be left alone. Do you get recognized around your area?
No, not really. I mean, I actually still get recognized more as a veterinarian than I am as an author.
All right.
Grocery shopping, I still live in the same area where my clinic is, and... I'll get, you know, pulled aside for somebody asking some veterinary question or tell me how they missed me at the clinic, and so.
Will you ever have a book? I don't know why this suddenly came into my head. Will you ever have a book that about Jack the Ripper?
Actually, I was just on a talk to somebody else earlier today on another talk thing about Jack the Ripper. I don't know. I mean, it's been done a lot. I don't know what to do.
I'd like to hear your spin on it, though.
Yeah, I mean, he's in my mind somewhere. I mean, at some point, if I could find some way of using that as an element of a story, I would definitely take advantage of that. I just can't. I haven't come up with that idea yet.
Well, see, and that's the key there. It has to be something that makes sense. You can't just grab it from the middle of nowhere and plunk it into one of your novels,
right,
hoping it's going to fit, like having a square peg in a round hole. You know,
right.
It's got to fit perfectly, and that's the point. You know what's going to.
The question is, is there a new take? How can I take something, you know, Jack the Ripper's been done in so many different manners, from H.G. Wells adaptations to...
I guess I'm fascinated with Jack the Ripper. I mean,
it's a fascinating bit of history. I don't know how to take a unique take to that and make it fit into a story yet.
Right. But doing the research, imagine how much fun that would be.
That would be.
I mean, of course, we had Patricia Cuomo with her own take on what she thinks, but and she certainly seems credible. Who knows? I mean, is she right? Who will ever know? But I think it's interesting that you do those things. I look forward to seeing what's coming next. What you're gonna tackle next? That's half the fun of being a fan, is wondering where they're going next. What's the next book going to be about?
Yep, I've got some cool stuff coming up in this next book.
Right, and we look forward to that very much so. Well, we've been talking to James Rollins, whose new book is called The Devil Colony. It's out from Morrow in all your bookstores now. It's a national bestseller. It's been great fun. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.